Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week, Christians around the world celebrate Easter, the holiest day on their religious calendar. It marks the crucifixion of Jesus, who they believe died for the sins of man, sins that derive from the original sin committed in the Garden of Eden by Adam and Eve. Historically, Eve has received more blame for that fateful event than Adam. And that is the subject of our interview today with Pamela Norris. But before we talk about Eve, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1836, Sam Houston ensured Texas independence from Mexico when he defeated Mexican President General Antonio López de Santa Anna at the Battle of San Jacinto. Houston first moved to Texas in 1832, and he immediately began to encourage other Americans to settle in that sparsely settled region. In 1833, Houston was elected by the settlers to negotiate greater autonomy from Mexico, and when that failed, the province simply declared its independence. Houston was elected commander-in-chief of the Texan Rebel Army, and on April 21, 1836, he surprised Santa Anna, who was leading his army into Texas to suppress the rebellion, at the San Jacinto River, defeating the Mexican army and taking Santa Anna prisoner. Houston became the first president of the Texas Republic, and in 1845, when Texas was admitted to the Union, he was elected that state's first U.S. senator. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, recently at an archaeological research conference in Santa Fe, New Mexico, two scientists challenged the widely accepted theory that the first people to settle North America came from Asia across the Bering Strait. Dennis Stanford and Bruce Bradley argue instead that the first settlers may have been European nomads who crossed an ice-jammed North Atlantic 18,000 years ago. A reevaluation of the journey of Captain William Clark and Meriwether Lewis is bringing deserved attention to a long-forgotten member of the expedition, a black man named York. York, Captain Clark's slave, was chosen for the trip because of his excellent hunting and woodworking skills, and while York was greatly valued by the members of the team, when the voyage ended, he remained a slave and his contributions hardly mentioned. Now, almost 300 years later, Kentucky historian James Holmberg is trying to set the record straight. According to Holmberg, at the time of the expedition, York was never an official member of the Corps of Discovery. He was always William Clark's slave, and as a result, forgotten, at least until now. You're listening to Talking History. According to the Bible, she succumbed to the wiles of the serpent and then tempted her soulmate Adam into a sin that recast the fate of mankind. It's a fascinating story with meaning for the ages, and it's the subject of our interview for this week's program with Eileen Dugan and her guest, Pamela Norris.
She is temptation itself. As the serpent slyly watches over her bare shoulder, she hands the fruit to the unsuspecting man. She seems to be oblivious to the sorrows to come, unconcerned that she is precipitating the fall of man, unaware of how this instant will forever be remembered. She, of course, is Eve, if not that of the strictest biblical reading, at least the Eve of popular imagination, beautiful, sensuous, and devastatingly beguiling. With us to discuss the history of Eve is Ms. Pamela Norris, literary scholar and author of the recent book, Eve, A Biography, A Study of Our Perception of History's First Bad Girl, from biblical times through the present. Welcome, Pamela. Just what does the Bible tell us about the story of Eve? I mean, how prominent, for example, is she in the Old Testament?
Well, interestingly, she's not very prominent at all. Eve appears only in the first book of the Old Testament, in Genesis, where there are two stories which tell of the creation of the first man and woman. The first story doesn't mention Eve by name at all, and it appears in the first book of Genesis. And it tells how God created the world in 6 days, and how on the sixth day he creates the first human couple, the man and the woman, and gives them dominion over every living thing. And he instructs them to be fruitful and multiply. Now, chapter 2 of Genesis goes back to a much older and better-known story, and this is where the familiar Eve of myth appears. And in this story, God creates Adam out of dust, and he puts him in a garden. And later, he makes a woman out of one of Adam's ribs to be his partner, to be his helpmate. And this story then goes on to tell how the woman is tempted by a serpent to eat forbidden fruit. And as a result of this, Adam and Eve have to leave the Garden of Eden and set out into the world. Adam is condemned to dig the ground to produce food, and Eve is condemned to give birth to children. And they also are both condemned to death eventually at the end of their lives. And this marks the beginning of human history and time. Now, Eve actually acquires her name at the end of this account because Adam calls her Eve, mother of all living. And the only later references to Eve in the Bible are in the context of her giving birth to sons, the two boys, Cain and Abel, and to the good son, Seth, who is the first real survivor, and he is the first in the line of very important men in early Judaism. He is the progenitor of both Noah and Abraham, who, of course, are sort of key characters in the Old Testament.
And how does Eve compare to the goddesses of the ancient Near East and Greek mythology, for example?
Well, this is very interesting. She's very different from these goddesses, simply because she is not a goddess. She was not revered as a goddess. Her role was to be a progenitor. She was the mother of all living. She was never worshipped, and unlike the Hebrew goddess Ashtoreth or Canaanite Asherah or the Greek goddess Artemis, she had no supernatural powers to protect women in childbirth. Her closest resemblance, in fact, in mythology is to Pandora, who in classical mythology was the first human woman. And she was created really as a punishment for human men. I mean, Pandora is known as the beautiful evil, and from her sprang the race of women. She invented women. And women were regarded by the Greeks as troublemakers, people who bring all sorts of ills, hard work, disease, poverty, and so on to mankind. And so Eve has no goddess status, although there are some very, very nice stories in rabbinic tradition which give her status as a matriarch. She's married or matched to women like Sarah, who was the mother of Abraham, to Rebecca, who is the mother of Isaac, to Rachel, who's the mother of Jacob. But really, most seriously, Eve's status in Judaism and indeed in the Bible is this notion of motherhood and also of bringing death into the world. So unlike the powerful goddesses of the ancient Near East and the classical world, who control and elevate human destiny by their powers of life and death, Eve's importance is really undermined by the mortality to which she condemned the human race by eating forbidden fruit. And so she's seen as quite a negative figure in terms of the Judaic tradition.
And how did she come to be interpreted by early Christian groups as well?
Well, this is very interesting. Judaism loved telling stories, and so there's this very, very long tradition of storytelling in Judaism about Adam and Eve, which Christianity simply absorbed and then redefined according to its own needs. And if I can start a little bit with some of these early Jewish stories, because they then feed into the Christian tradition, and it would help to explain this a little bit better. But the Jewish stories about Adam and Eve were really attempts to come to terms with ideas about where does evil come from, what are the origins of human suffering. The real problem for both Judaism and Christianity was that if you had monotheism as a religion, if you believed in an omnipotent God, how did you explain things like floods and famine and disease? And both the Jews and the Christians turn to the story of the Garden of Eden to try and explain this problem. Where did horrors come from? And in doing this, they develop the characters of Adam and Eve and their children far beyond the limits of the original Genesis story. One of the stories which gained great popularity was the tradition that Eve's temptation was a story of sexual conquest. Now, in the original story in Genesis, in the Old Testament, sexuality isn't really an issue. The forbidden fruit is not necessarily sex, and indeed for the very, very early Jewish groups it wouldn't have been sex at all. But the story that became developed by the Jews and was then picked up by the Christians was the idea that Eve was tempted, sexually tempted, not by the serpent, but by somebody much more sinister, a rebel angel. He took his revenge on God by tempting Eve and then Adam into fatal disobedience. Now, this is a wonderful story. It's a very, very powerful story. And, of course, it was a story which Milton picked up as the basis for his great poem, Paradise Lost, many, many centuries later on.
And how go ahead.
I was just going to sort of go on and talk a little bit about how the early Christians took up the story of Eve. And it was really St. Paul who saw a connection between, not so much between Eve, as between Adam and Christ. And Paul explained that the death and resurrection of Christ reversed the curse on mankind, which was brought about by man's disobedience in the Garden of Eden. And Paul said, as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. And at the same time, theologians at this period were quick to point out that it was Eve's fault, that this business of death was really Eve's fault. Adam was not deceived, that the woman being deceived was in the transgression. And they developed this idea that women would be saved in childbearing, which refers to God's commandment to Eve, in sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. So Christianity really emphasized the aspect of Eve as a wicked woman. She had brought distress on earth, but women could be saved from the curse of Eve by childbearing.
And how did medieval theologians continue this development of the notion of Eve?
Well, I think that probably, rather than talking about individual theologians, I can perhaps just sort of give you some kind of context. I wonder if this would be useful, because I think what is really important about how Eve evolved in the medieval period is the context of misogyny, this idea that woman was sexually dangerous, and the idea that woman was very morally frail and liable to temptation. Now, both of these ideas derived directly from the story of Eve, which was hugely influential and which was endorsed by other popular heroines by stories about Pandora and about all those passionate, flawed women in Greek tragedy. So there was misogyny was current, but there was also a social reason why the story of Eve was very, very important to theologians. By this period, stable marriage, clear lines of inheritance were very, very significant to almost all sectors of society, but particularly to landowners and the nobility of early modern Europe, people who provided enormous financial support for the church. So you've got a situation where the church, the landowners, important people want to control sexuality. They particularly want to control female sexuality. They want to protect young women from promiscuous childbearing, and they want to impose taboos on the sexual behavior of young men. And so the idea of Eve, this notion of God's decree to Eve, thy desire shall be to thy husband and he shall rule over thee, was very, very useful to the church and very, very useful to the community at large. As was the widely promoted belief that women could be saved by childbearing. So, again, Eve was brought in as kind of ammunition against women. You must be subjected to men, and it's very, very important that you have babies, but only within the context of appropriate marriage.
So how did Eve end up getting this image as being a beautiful sexual temptress?
I think it was just such an alluring idea. I think the idea of a beautiful woman offering forbidden fruit, offering forbidden temptations, has been current for absolutely centuries. And there was Eve, first of all, in the Bible, but there are lots and lots of other tempting women in the Bible. Delilah springs to mind, tempting Samson. And this was a very, very seductive idea. And the rabbis, the whole rabbinic tradition, was absolutely convinced that that women, sexually alluring women, were out to tempt men, to attract them away from their respect for God, from their honorable lives. And nothing could be more alluring than this notion that Eve was actually a very, very beautiful woman, because beautiful women were absolutely taboo. And Eve was very, very quickly equated with all the other sexual temptresses that litter history and myth. She was like Helen of Troy, who was responsible for the death of so many men. She was like Cleopatra, who ruined Antony. And, of course, like Cleopatra, she was linked with a death-dealing serpent. She was like Pandora. She was like the Greek Lamia, a voluptuous snake woman who was fatal to women. She was also linked with the Jewish Lilith, Lilith, who was believed in some traditions to be Adam's first wife, a feminist who refused to have sex with Adam, and who was responsible for sexy dreams and for night emissions. She was a woman who stole a man's sexual power and self-control as he slept. So these notions of women who attracted you and forced you to do terrible things, they were terribly seductive in all of these traditions. Something that people like to talk about, oh, this is terrible, we must have, these women are ghastly creatures, and yet at the same time they're so beautiful, we cannot resist them.
Well, so far we've been talking about how men have interpreted Eve, but what do women have to say about Eve?
I think that there's a lot said about Eve by women, and the reason why we don't, we traditionally haven't got to hear about it very much, is that it was never promoted and never put out by men. So that you have, throughout history, you have a number of women who've said some very, very interesting things about Eve, but you know, they say it and then their story dies away. And one of the earliest and most individual accounts of Eve was a series of commentaries by the visionary abbess Hildegard of Bingen, who was writing in the 12th century, and she has beautiful ideas about both Adam and Eve, in which she stresses the reciprocity of the relationship between men and women. She says that Adam sees his own image and likeness in Eve, and as they gaze at one another, their mutual gaze reflects the generations to come. So they're like two mirrors facing each other, endlessly duplicating any image that stands between them. She said that while Adam symbolizes the divinity of Christ, Eve represents Christ's humanity. Her primary significance in the divine scheme of things was to reveal the hidden God by giving him birth. So it's woman who gives birth to man and who then nurtures him. And she talks about procreation being an act of reciprocity. The air and the wind work together. And contrary to these negative views of sexuality which the early church fathers promoted, Hildegard stressed Adam's love for Eve. And all of these ideas supported Eve's dignity and her status and her importance in God's plan. Now, after Hildegard, a number of other women, Christine de Pizan, for example, the aristocratic French woman, she asserted the nobility of Eve. She said that Eve was created by supreme craftsmen, and like Adam, she was made in the image of God. And she also said that Eve's fault brought honor to humanity. It was a felix culpa, a happy fault, because if there hadn't been Eve, there wouldn't have been Christ, and there wouldn't have been the possibility of redemption and life eternal.
Well, we only have a moment remaining, but perhaps you could just say a few words about the meaning that the story of Eve, or perhaps even the history of the story of Eve, might hold for us today.
I think that the history of the story of Eve is not very positive, because what we see in the history of Eve was a story that was used again and again to repress and silence women. But if we want to read it as a story with a message for women today, we can actually say that it's a wonderful example of female initiative. By daring to eat the forbidden fruit, Eve laid claim to knowledge in all its richness and plenitude, and she kick-started humanity into history. Eden was very pleasant, But it was a very repetitive life. What Eve made possible was the challenge and variety of change. She offered the opportunity for work, the beginnings of a moral life. Once she and Adam had tasted the forbidden fruit, they knew what good and evil meant. They could begin to take responsibility for their actions. So really, the story of Eve is a stunning endorsement of female energy, of female courage and initiative. I think it's a very, very positive story for us today.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Pamela.
Thank you.
We have been talking to Ms. Pamela Norris, literary scholar and author of the recent book, Eve, A Biography.
The debate between creationists and evolutionists over the meaning of the biblical account of creation continues to be a much debated point, as witnessed to by recent developments in Kansas and elsewhere. Here to provide some historical perspective on these recent developments is Robert Pennock. Pennock is a professor of philosophy and religion at the College of New Jersey. He's also the author of Tower of Babel, The Evidence Against the New Creationism.
In the wake of the decision this past summer of the Kansas State Board of Education to delete evolution from its curriculum standards, presidential candidate George W. Bush stunned scientists by endorsing a policy of local control over whether creationism could be taught in public school science classes. Other candidates followed suit, although Al Gore said he would allow creationism only in comparative religion classes. That the candidates passed this political hot potato to local authorities may not be surprising, but it is still disheartening. Although local control may initially sound fair-minded, for science this is terrible educational policy. The facts of nature, like the facts of history, are not appropriately decided by political compromise. Around the time of the Scopes trial, schools in Zion, Illinois, not only rejected evolution, but also infidel theories of a moving round earth, choosing to teach the, quote, biblical flat earth view. Well, what might be expected of local control of the creationism issue today? In recent years, several school boards have wanted to use the Bible as a textbook in science classes. But while biologists speak about mitochondrial Eve to refer to the source of mitochondrial DNA, the biblical Eve is not a real alternative. Other school boards have tried to adopt the textbook of Pandas and People, which has students, in its words, choose for themselves between the two theories of evolution and intelligent design. In fact, there's not one, but many creationist views. Most creationists reject the Big Bang, hence its removal from the Kansas standards, but a few adopt it as a nifty proof of creation ex nihilo. Most reject the standard geological timescale, gone in Kansas as well, and say that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, but a few are old earthers. Many believe that God created the different human languages at the Tower of Babel, but others accept linguistic evolution. Nor are all creationists biblical literalists. In Oregon, the Utamila tribe recently clashed with the Asatru Folk Assembly, a pagan group, about whose gods had created whose ancestors first in that region. The Raelian movement holds that all life on Earth was created by extraterrestrials. A Hindu group in Kansas thanked the board for removing evolution. They claim the evidence supported a Vedic view of millions of years of cyclic human history. Does fairness really demand that any such view be included? Once scientific constraints are removed, any religious group can analyze the evidence in their own favor. So what should the candidates have said? That they would uphold the Constitution and the Supreme Court rulings on this issue, which have consistently ruled against creationism. That the U.S. depends upon state-of-the-art science and that schools should teach no less. What we got instead was an ill-advised political compromise, one that compromises the integrity of science and compromises the education of American schoolchildren.
You've been listening to Robert Pennock, author of Tower of Babel, The Evidence Against the New Creationism, published by MIT Press in 1999. This is Talking History. Thank you. continuing on the biblical theme of our program, we've chosen for our site of the week a little-known museum that accents the Bible's historical significance. Here to tell you about that museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
In a small community east of Memphis, Tennessee, there is a small museum that contains an interesting array of biblical artifacts, including a replica of the Rosetta Stone. The nonprofit, non-denominational Biblical Museum and Resource Center contains a wealth of biblical archaeological information and artifacts. The center, which opened in 1997, has drawn several hundred visitors, and many religious groups tour the center to view replicas of items like the Taylor Prism and real artifacts, including a tiny 2,000-year-old oil lamp. The director of the center, Don Bassett, who retired after 35 years in the pulpit ministry, says the replicas play an important role for those people who can't make it to places like the British Museum to see the originals. So the next time you're in Memphis, you may want to travel just a little further east to Collierville to see this special little museum.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. A weekend of festivities is planned for the opening of the Joe Grandee Museum of the Frontier West at the National Cowboy Hall of Fame on April 28th and 29th. The new museum will display nearly 450 artifacts that present interpretive themes reflecting historical currents and people in the 19th century American West. The museum will host an American West symposium as part of its opening celebration on Saturday, April 29th. To learn more about the opening of the Grandee Museum, contact the National Cowboy Hall of Fame in Oklahoma City. If you can't make it to Oklahoma, try the History Channel and 100 Years of Terror. On April 24th, the series opens with A Legacy of Violence, a look at the origins of 20th century terrorism in the Russian Revolution. On April 25th, The War Against Colonialism examines the use of terror by colonial nations against colonial powers. The World of International Terrorism is the subject of Terror Goes International on April 26th, while on April 27th, The Fright Decades looks at the reign of religious terror in the 1990s. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact time of these programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look at the quiz show scandals of the 1950s. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.